Hey, Mike Valenti here, host of Cash the Ticket alongside my partner, Jim Costa. It's really simple. Are you tired of podcasts claiming they're a bunch of pro bettors when they live in their mommy's basement? Are you tired of podcasts that claim they hit 80% of the games when really they just lose like most of us? Then Cash the Ticket's the spot for you. We're real. We're transparent. We're having a hell of a good time with it. And we sit there and we're there for the sweat with you guys. We're just trying to figure it out just like you. Follow and listen to Cash the Ticket on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
God bless those poor people in Florida with Milton heading that way and almost survivor's guilt here because the weather's so nice. A little touch of fall outside. Not cool, really, I don't think, but the humidity's down, and it's going up to 86 today. Sunny and nice tomorrow, highs of 84, 82 Friday. And then they're saying the first kind of real cool front come next Tuesday with high temperatures only in the upper 70s, which will feel really nice. Arthur Sturbco joins us now, our friend, local real estate analyst. How you doing, Arthur?
Good morning, Tommy. Doing great.
What is the state of the real estate market in the southeastern Louisiana area?
A little bit depressed right now. Obviously, hurricane season is on everyone's mind. Mm-hmm. We sure don't need to be reminded about what a hurricane does to a market, but it's certainly on the mind of some buyers as well. Added to, of course, our insurance issues we've talked about ad nauseum. But it certainly slowed down a bit. The good news is that the interest rates have really calmed down and has brought some buyers back into the market. So prices, if homes are priced right, they're selling in a couple of days. If they're not, then there's an issue. But certainly some sellers are now starting to adjust their prices based upon the insurance premiums that the buyers are looking at.
How does either the seller or the buyer know that the home is priced right?
Well,
beforehand, after it's over, I mean, everybody realizes, I guess, that it was the right price, but beforehand, Arthur?
Well, you can still look at comparables. You know, what are other properties in the neighborhood selling for? And just as important, what are other properties on the market that are staying on the market priced at? Mm-hmm. So that's probably as good a benchmark as what's being sold. So if you see your neighbor's homes and it's been on the market for 2, 3, 4, 5 months, and you see his price and your home is just like it, well, I would strongly suggest that unless there's something really weird or strange inside that home, you better adjust your price accordingly to underprice it from what your neighbors is. So a good realtor is going to have a good handle on what the comparable sales are, what the pending sales are. Sometimes those don't really appear in the multiple listing service. So you may see a home that's listed for, let's say, $300,000 and it showed pending. Well, it's not going to show the actual sales price until it goes to an active sale. But many times a realtor or an appraiser can call the selling broker or the listing broker and say, look, this is just for comparable purposes. Do you mind letting me, know what the price is? And sometimes they'll tell you, sometimes they won't. Confidentiality, they're really not supposed to. But sometimes, mm-hmm. If it's for just a comp and they know the agent that's involved, then they'll probably be open with you and help you price your property. When cooperation with realtors is pretty widespread.
Somebody texted this in. I do want to bring the audience in at 504-260-1870. Arthur's a vastly experienced real estate agent, so if you got any questions about the home buying process or selling process, text them into the Oakland Art Jeweler talking text line at 504-260-1870. Somebody texted this in, and this could apply to my home as well. Not that I'm even thinking about selling it, but my kitchen hasn't been touched since 1993, I think, when I built the house. So it's still got the formica and the cherry cabinets and all of that kind of stuff. When it comes to upgrading a house or giving the seller a blank canvas, how do you know where to put money into it and when you're going to get that money back, when it's going to increase the sale of the house, when you're just wasting money? You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, and it's nice to hear that your kitchen belongs to the Smithsonian, Tommy.
It does. But you know what, Arthur? Let me tell you this, my friend. It's going to come back. Trust me. 10 years from now, everybody will be doing that again.
I still have some wad ties. I'm still waiting for those to come back, too.
Yeah,
the best place to start finding out what's attractive, find some magazines that are on the shelf. Go online and look at some of the the homes and the kitchens and see what people are really looking for. And of course, locally, the best thing to do is consult a realtor or a couple of realtors and ask them for ideas and suggestions. They're going to know. Many times they're selling homes with their dated kitchens, and they're getting the feedback back from their buyers of, you know, oh, gee, we're going to change this up. We're going to change that. Oh, my gosh, Formica. Oh, my gosh. We, you know, or, hey, you know, Formica doesn't really bother me because Formica now looks so – they make it so it almost looks like marble. So
not,
if you've
not
got
mine.
Some dated Formica – probably not.
Mine's white.
But you have to also take a look at, you know, do you want to replace those marble counters with, you know, some strange – I would hate to say strange color, but let's just say – an unusual color that's not going to go with most people's, you know, furnishings when they move in. So sometimes if you are going to make a change, do something that's fairly muted or going to be attractive to most people, not something you particularly like that's just according to your taste, but something that's going to appeal to most people. So if you are going to make some radical changes to your kitchen, which I always approve of and I strongly suggest, it's probably the best place you can make improvements and get your dollar back. Make sure that you put, whether it's light fixtures, plumbing fixtures, put something in things in there that are going to be widely received by people and going to, oh, this is really nice. You know, and good idea is just simply go to your local, you know, Lowe's or Home Depot or other appliance type stores and see what's out there if you want to spend the time to do that. But a good realtor could give you some good suggestions.
What about not spending anything and leaving it as a, quote, blank canvas? Is that going to cost you money?
Well, maybe not. It depends on how blank what your blank canvas looks like.
Kitchen from the 90s, and you can, you know, do whatever you want with it.
Well, if the floor plan is great and the house has been well-maintained, the landscaping looks great, the front door has been freshly painted. That has always been a key thing for me. You
really?
Paint the front door. Oh, absolutely. I tell this to people all the time. When people come to the front door, they don't even realize it, but they see the front door. That's the first thing they really see. The landscaping in the front, of course. But when they see the front door and it's worn and the paint's all faded and, you know, the door handles are all chipped or whatever, people think, well, gosh, and what is the rest of the house going to look like? What else are they not taking care of? So the best thing to do, I always tell people, if you have a front door and it doesn't look like it's in pristine condition, repaint the thing. And the first thing that happens when people repaint the front door is then they start looking at the rest of the trim and they go, oh, wait, well, now the door looks great, but now look at the rest of the trim. It looks terrible. Yeah, right, it does. You should have painted that too. So it kind of leads into the next step of upgrading the paint on the exterior if that's all faded and looks worn too.
And even if the paint is good, I would think you want to, you know, because first impressions everything, right? You get the cobwebs off, do a little pressure washing, do a little wipe down, make sure everything's clean when they see the front door, because then from there they judge everything from that.
Correct. And don't paint a chartreuse or something weird. You know, find something, again, that's going to be, you know, generally accepted by the public. And if somebody wants to custom paint it afterwards, that's fine, but make sure that it looks nice. You know, freshly painted anything, it smells good, smells fresh, looks great. And it looks like it's in good condition. The home is in good condition, been maintained.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Arthur Sturbco. We'll talk about specific areas when we come back. Somebody texted in about, y'all are talking about kitchens. What about bathrooms or other specific rooms? Somebody else wants to know about interior paint colors. Somebody else wants to know about exterior paint colors and the trends with the outside of houses, specifically that now everything is white and soft gray, it seems like. So should you paint your house to look like that? But if you do, what if it changes in a year? You're still trying to sell a house. Oy vey, 621 traffic now, WWL.
From Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters, WWL Traffic Center, I'm Courtney P. Bonnie Carey Spillway, no delays to report in either direction. However, I-10 East Kenner 2 downtown New Orleans, heavy delay starts right at about Loyola now. Two veterans where an accident is clearing. Traffic remains clear to downtown from there. I-10 West New Orleans East to downtown, no problems there. Downtown elevated clear to the flyover. Flyover lightly congested to Business 90. Crescent City Connection, West Bank to downtown, wide open in both directions. Huey P. Long in the Causeway, no delays there. I-55 north and southbound free and clear. No delays on I-12. I-59 is delay free. Traffic is sponsored by Thibodeau Regional Health System.
627, Tommy Tucker, WWL, having a conversation with Arthur Sturbco, local real estate analyst. Arthur, what are some of the hotter areas, hotter places in the area, I should say?
Well, one of the hottest areas right now is in the Covington area. There's a tremendous amount of road improvements that are being done in the Covington, Abita Springs area, all going out to that Hammond area. So insurance certainly is getting people to take a look at that area, and that seems to be pretty hot right now. The other areas that are good, of course, are always going to be in those iconic neighborhoods uptown around the universities and things like that. Belchase, of course, with all the construction down there, the LNG plant down there. For your listeners who have not been down there to see that thing, it is something to behold. It is incredible. That whole, just the parking lots for the trucks are incredible. They're bigger than the Superdome. It's incredible.
Yeah, them trucks got to get in there and back. You know what I'm saying?
Past your house, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, at some point they'll stop, but it looks like that's still going to be a while. But they're going 100 miles an hour down there.
There's the bridge mess as well, David. Wait, I mean, Arthur, there's the bridge mess as well. You forgot about that, so you can add that in too. Somebody texted in about exterior color of homes, and there is an area they're building in Belchase off of Belchase Highway. And it seems like every home is white with black or gray trim. Is that the new trend? And how often do these trends change, if you had to guess?
Well, yeah, that is kind of trendy right now, that kind of black and white motif for exterior paint on a lot of newer construction. But there's so, when you say white, I mean, if you go to these paint stores and you get the paint samples, you go, well, how many different kinds of white are there? There is a brown white, there's a gray white, there's a red white. I don't know what. Listen, I'm colorblind, so I'm the wrong guy to ask. I'd find a realtor that's not colorblind or go to a paint store and say, what should we use? One of my favorite stories, when I used to be with builders and with buyers at the same time, the buyer would say, or the who was getting ready to build, what color do you think we should put on the exterior? That was the last thing the contractor wanted to say, was give that man and that woman a color. I mean, no matter what color they picked out, it was going to be wrong. Whatever you think. No, that's a personal choice. You have to make that choice. I don't want to get in the middle of that. Just knew that was a no-win situation.
Some movie where the woman's picking her colors and it's like sunset crimson and eggshell this and that and the other, and the painter tells the contractor tells the painter white, yellow, red, and blue, because that's what it turns out to be, right? Thank you, Arthur.
Exactly.
Take it easy.
All right, Tom.
Pleasure
Thank
as always.
You.
Arthur Sturbco, local real estate analyst. When we come back, we're going to talk to David Schultz. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University. We'll get the latest on the presidential race. A lot going on with back and forth about FEMA. And now Bob Woodward's book, but is it going to change anybody's mind? We'll see when we return on WWL. 6:45, quarter till 7. Weather's going to be nice here. Real cool front coming in next Tuesday. Highs then only in the upper 70s, so we'll wait for that. Meanwhile, hope and pray for the people in Florida, because we know what it's like to sit and wait and wonder. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University. How you doing, professor?
I am doing great, and I hope you're doing well.
I am. The hurricanes, both Helene and Milton, have kind of factored into the race. I don't know. They've entered into the race. I don't know if it's become a factor or not, the response of FEMA. One spinning it one way, one spinning it the other way. I don't know what's true or what's not. Either way, is it going to have any effect on the people that are going to determine the election?
It doesn't look like it at this point. What it might have an impact on, and we just don't know yet, is in terms of voting. We first hope that nothing's going to be really more devastating, in Florida, but we know from some past hurricanes, I think it happened in your state with Katrina, that it altered voting patterns where people were, and it had some impact on voter turnout. And so it could potentially have impacts in terms of, some voting in Florida maybe Georgia and so forth. So Georgia is a possibility where North Carolina, depending on what the path of this hurricane is going to be. We know Helene went through North Carolina, maybe affects the voting in two of the swing states, but it's just still not clear in terms of how it's going to affect actual voting in terms of who can show up or not show up. And it's possible that it might affect you know, some perceptions. And I say all the possibles because the race is so close in those two states that it, moving a couple thousand votes here or there, you know, could be determinative for the race.
You said Florida and North Carolina, right?
I meant to say Georgia.
But what about North Carolina? Because that's a swing state as well, and they were hit really hard. Is it Trump was? I heard Trump say that it was Republican counties or Republican areas that were hit hard. He was concerned about people getting to the polls, telling them to crawl if they had to, et cetera. Is that going to have any? And that's all, you know, political hyperbole, I guess, but is it going to have any practical effect, as far as you know, on people being able to vote? Or could that, could, here's a question, I guess, Professor, could Helene in any way swing the presidential election just from the logistics of people voting, et cetera?
It's possible at this point. Now, we still, of course, have several weeks to go. What do we have, about 25 days before the election, approximately, you know, and it is possible in some of those more western parts of North Carolina, which are much more likely to vote Republican, it's possible that the difficulty of getting to vote, or let's just be honest here, you know, if your house has been devastated, you're probably more worried about your house than you're worried about whether or not you're going to vote. And I'm not criticizing anybody, but that would be my priority in life too. So it is possible, again, in a state where the polls are indicating that the race in North Carolina is razor thin. Again, a few thousand votes could be enough to sway the election one way or the other.
Kamala Harris on Stephen Colbert last night drinking a beer, and I guess she's just being herself, laughing and having a good time, it seems like. Donald Trump, on the other hand, is pushing doom and gloom, and I don't know. Again, does any of this matter other than when you look at those thousands of voters that are going to determine the election?
That's really what it's going to come down to at this point. It's just those few thousand voters. Again, you heard me say this before, 150,000 to 200,000 voters in about six states are going to affect the election.
Say that again, David, just a little bit slower so people understand. Say it again?
Yeah. What's going to happen here is that at the end of the day, there's only about six states that are going to really matter in the election. And within those six states, I've been arguing that across total, all six states, about 150,000 to 200,000 voters are going to actually decide the election.
And give me those states, if you can, just for people that don't know.
Sure. So it'll be Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Maybe we add into it North Carolina. If we push it a little bit more, maybe we add to it Nevada. So if we go there, we're up to seven states. But still, my point being is that at the end of the day, 150,000 to 200,000 voters are going to really decide this election. And it's not clear if these are people who are truly undecided versus, and therefore, I don't know if I'm going to vote Trump versus Biden. I doubt there's anybody out there like that at this point. I mean, Trump versus Harris, I meant to say. Or is it people who are saying, I'm not sure if I want to show up to vote or not. But in either case, it's an infinitesimally small number of people. Again, when I say 150,000 to 200,000, I'm not meaning in each state. I'm meaning across all those five or six or seven states.
It's incredible when you think about it. All the money that's being spent, all the attention that's being directed at the election. And I saw a piece on CBS News last night where I think it was one state that they're just putting up blue dots or red dots, trying to make it a little bit more civil, and blue pumpkins and red pumpkins instead of specific people, just to voice their preference whether it should be red or blue. We'll take a break, pick it up here. We come back. We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. 150,000 to 200,000 people across six states. So what is it that they're looking for? What do we know about these people? We'll find out more when we come back. Right now it's time for traffic on WWL.
From Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters, WWL Traffic Center, I'm Courtney P. I-10 East Kenner 2 downtown New Orleans have moderate delay between the airport area and Veterans. Traffic does clear to downtown from there. I-10 West New Orleans East to downtown. The slowdown begins between Reed and Crowder. Light congestion continues to the high rise. Downtown elevated slow but steady from St. Bernard to the flyover. Flyover moderately congested to Business 90. Crescent City Connection West Bank to downtown. Light congestion begins at Terry Parkway. Huey P. Long the causeway, no delays there. I-55 north and southbound free and clear. No delays on I-12. I-59 is delay free. This has been a look at traffic with Courtney P on WWL.
657, 3 till 7. Somebody texted in about Tommy, it's clear your candidate is going to lose. I've not expressed a preference on the candidates. I've detached myself, David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, because it doesn't matter in Louisiana, it doesn't matter who I vote for. But you know what does matter? Down ballot races. So for people that hear about, and somebody texted us in, it's another good point about whether you think your presidential vote matters or not, your down ballot vote definitely matters. And with that in mind, what about the congressional race in the Senate? What's that looking like? What's it shaping up to be, as far as you can tell?
What it looks like right now is that the Republicans have an edge to be able to pick up both Montana, which is held by a Democrat, and West Virginia, held by a Democrat. And if they were able to do that, they would be able to flip the Senate to Republican control. Right now, the House is just too close to call. I mean, what's going to be interesting about it is that it looks like the decisive House races are going to come down to races in California, in New York, races where the Democrats 2 years ago took for granted that they were just going to win these races and lost them. And so now they're competing for them again. So it's incredibly razor close in the House. And this is sort of the story for everything. If you think about it here, across the country, the presidential race is very close. The Senate race, or its control for the Senate, is very, very close overall. And for the House, I mean, we are such a divided country at this point. I mean, if just about 50-50, even though some states like yours or mine might be more Democrat or more Republican. But overall, it's an incredibly divided country right now, with each side, you know, almost like, you know, equally matched in terms of votes and support. And this is important to think about, because after the election, winners always want to claim mandates. When the dust settles, we're going to probably get somebody who wins with maybe 50% plus 1% of the vote, or one of the House, or one of the parties has bare control of the House or the Senate. I don't think anybody can really claim a mandate, but they're going to do so. And in an era of winner take all politics, are going to act as if they won an overwhelming victory.
We're out of time now. Next time we're going to have to pick it up with, it's one thing to campaign and win an election, it's another to govern. And I don't know if the congressional races are being ignored by the presidential candidates, because if you have a Democratic president and a Republican House and Senate, chances are not, a lot's not going to happen. Or if you have a Republican president, Democratic Senate, Democratic House, not a lot's going to happen. So we'll pick it up there next time we talk to you. When we come back, we're going to talk to David Elias, orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA. Talk about Derek Carr's oblique injury on WWL.
Hey, Mike Valeni here, host of Cash the Ticket alongside my partner, Jim Costa. It's really simple. Are you tired of podcasts claiming they're a bunch of pro bettors when they live in their mommy's basement? Are you tired of podcasts that claim they hit 80% of the games when really they just lose like most of us? Then Cash the Ticket's the spot for you. We're real, we're transparent, we're having a hell of a good time with it, and we sit there and we're there for the sweat with you guys. We're just trying to figure it out just like you. Follow and listen to Cash the Ticket on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And quickly to David Elias, MD, an orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA, to talk about oblique injuries, although the doctor can't discuss Derek Carr because, Dr. Elias, you've not examined Derek Carr, right?
Correct.
But let's talk about, and look, I appreciate your time. I know you jammed up. Let's talk about the obliques. What are they? When we hear about oblique injury, I don't think people really know what that is.
Well, it's definitely a strange injury, but you do see it in football players and other sports, and it's really not even an orthopedic injury. The the oblique muscles are basically the muscles over your abdomen, over your stomach, and you have two of them, the internal oblique and external oblique. And just like any muscle in your arm or leg, it attaches bone to bone. So these muscles attach from your rib cage, and they go down and attach to your pelvis. So you have two on each side. And like any strain, you can tear the muscle at the muscle belly or at the tendon junction, which is what attaches the muscle to the bone. Mm-hmm. So it's really no way to know where he sprained or tore the muscle. The most common way to have this happen, there's two ways. Really, it can be direct contact, get hit with a helmet, or it can be a sudden twisting motion where the muscle just, you forcefully contract the abdomen muscle and it tears. So I think that's probably what we're seeing here.
Yeah, he said it wasn't a hit. Derek Carr did in the press conference after that. It was the motion. Is this the same as the core, doctor? Is that what you're talking about or not?
The core, yeah. I mean, the core, your core is your abdominal muscles. So there's other muscles, but when they talk about the oblique strain, those are kind of the muscles that run on your right side and left side, again, attached from your rib to your pelvis. The good news is it's a non-operative injury, and, you know, across the board, the average oblique injury is usually back in 4 to 5 weeks, and you really just treat it with anti-inflammatories, therapy, and rest.
When you said it's non-orthopedic or not an orthopedic injury, that means there's no surgical remedy or not really?
There's usually no surgical remedy. And most muscle strains, we're treating conservative. So unless they directly pull off the bone, which I guess that could happen in this situation, and, you know, that would be probably a general surgeon that would take care of that. But I can't say I've ever heard of too many athletes with this injury who've had surgery. So it would be pretty unique to need surgery. Typically, this is seen probably by the sports doctor, the primary care sports doctor. And again, the treatment is rest and therapy and just over-the-counter anti-inflammatories.
Is there have we made any progress, or has medicine made any progress? I know what I'm talking about, but has medicine made any progress when it comes to the treatment of muscle sprains or strains or whatever you do to a muscle, like an oblique injury?
I think we've gotten smarter and a little more aggressive of knowing when to rest and when to rehab. There are different modalities. I mean, a lot of, you know, our hamstring or patella tendon, other injuries, will inject PRP, which is basically the patient's blood. You spin it down and you take all the growth factors from the patient's blood and you inject it into the site of injury. And that can have a positive inflammatory reaction that kind of helps healing. You know, there's some science out there, but I guess most insurance companies still think it's voodoo. So a lot of it's not really covered by insurance, but it's not completely proven. But I think you'll see a lot of PRP injections being done in a lot of these kind of muscle strains to try to speed the process up. And, you know, it makes sense to do that here. I just don't know. There's so many. It's so such a rare injury, and usually probably doesn't require that, but that would be the only interventional thing that I would think they may consider.
That would speed up recovery from this?
I don't know if it'll necessarily speed it up, but that's the theory, that it could speed it up and that it would help it heal stronger too, you know, just help provide the fertilizer, if you will, to heal the site of injury.
Tell me about it again, PRP?
It's called PRP, platelet-rich plasma, and it's very common in the athletic world, but in the sports medicine world, you basically take the patient's blood, you draw it out, and there's a little centrifuge machine. A lot of companies make them, and you spin it down, and you basically get rid of all the bad stuff in the blood, and you keep all the growth factors, kind of like stem cell, but not quite the same quality of stem cell. But it's kind of in the the science of the stem cell technology.
I heard Derek Carr say that he wanted to stay out there and fight, and they asked the doctors if there was anything they can do, and the doctor said there wasn't. I'm paraphrasing all of this now. There wasn't time for that. Is this anything that could be treated with, or talk about generally speaking, I guess, Dr. Elias, treating something like this with a painkiller and the dangers of doing that, or a local injection or something along those lines?
I mean, you could do that. You could make them feel better, and depending on the degree of the sprain, they might be able to mask some of the pain and go play. I guess the risk with any muscle strain is, are you going to cause more damage and then take an injury that would take 2 to 3 weeks to get better and extend it out to 6 to 8 weeks because you re-injured it? So that would be the risk. And again, it depends on the degree of his injury. Really, the only diagnostic study they could get is possibly an MRI. I'm sure they did that to look at the degree of injury, which will also lead them, the doctors taking care of him, to know how aggressive they can be with getting him into rehab and getting him back.
Generally speaking, is there a danger when you numb something like that where you go from a strain or a pull or whatever? What's the difference between a strain and a pull, first of all, and then to a tear?
Really no difference. We call a muscle, anytime you hear the word muscle strain, you're actually tearing muscle fibers.
Okay.
And, you know, the amount of muscle fibers you tear would just be the degree of the tear or sprain. So mild, moderate, severe. And I hadn't seen any terminology they've used with him.
So a pull is the same as a strain or a tear?
Pull is the same as a tear, yep. Pull, strain, muscle tear, yep.
What does something like this feel like if you have this?
I would assume it feels like a sharp cramp or like stabbing pain that he probably felt right on the side of his abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just like you'd feel with a hamstring or an Achilles, you feel that like sudden stabbing or snake bit feeling.
One question I have, and Lord knows I'm no athlete, but it seems like when the weekend warriors pull something, it's better to just rest it completely. But then with these athletes, they try to get them out on the field with a hamstring or something else. How do you draw the line with patients or athletes as an orthopedic surgeon when it comes to something like a hamstring injury or something along those lines between rehabbing it and resting it enough and then risking re-injuring it while you're not resting it enough, if that makes sense to you, Doc?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, again, every injury is different. I mean, anytime you strain or pull a muscle, no matter where it is, the initial treatment is going to be rest and just get the symptoms calmed down. And then as the patient can tolerate it, you get them into therapy and you start some exercises that kind of help stretch the muscle, help get rid of the scar tissue around the muscle. And really it's really a functional base. You know, if the patient's feeling better, you increase their function. And, you know, most physicians will make their patient go through some sort of functional return to play in the office before they send them out there in pads full speed.
So I guess what I'm asking is, would it be best for somebody with something like this, again, depending on the injury, or just the weekend warrior listening, to just sit and do nothing? Or do you work other muscles that you can, or do you risk hurting what you have already hurt if you do something else wrong?
I don't think he's going to risk hurting anything by getting into rehab early, but mm-hmm. he just may not feel like doing it early. So again, rest for him may be 2 to 3 days, and then I imagine they're going to get him into some rehab where they just kind of get the muscles moving again, get his abdomen twisting. I'm not sure what side it was, but for him, you know, he's turning. He turns to throw the ball one way more than the other. So, you know, I think that may have, you know, some sort of degree of when he comes back to, you know, what side did he injure?
I think it was his left side, if I remember him grabbing it when he went down. Either way, Doc, I appreciate your time. Generally speaking, we're talking about what, like 3-4 weeks here?
I'd say 3 to 5 weeks would be probably an average for the average oblique sprain.
3 to 5 weeks. Hey, thank you, Doc. I appreciate your time as always, all right? I know you're busy.
Okay.
Dr. David Elias, orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA. It was his left side. Tim reviewed the video. That's what he grabbed. So 3 to 5 weeks on Derek Carr. That's what we're looking at. You can text me if you want, 504-260-1870, Spencer Rattler or Jake Haner. I was surprised. Jake Haner is listed at 6'1", and Jake Haner did not look to me like he was 6'1". He looked like, I don't mean this in any disrespectful way at all, I'm just saying from the what do you call it, proportion, the size and the helmet and everything else, he looked like he was a very frail young man out there playing football. I don't know if Spencer Rattler's any bigger or not, but either way, who do you want, Rattler or Haner? I trust the Saints coaches to make the decision, both the mid-round picks. I don't know if there's a lot of political capital either way. Tim, we checking traffic here? What are we doing? 720, let's go to traffic, WWL. 744, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We feel for our friends in Florida. And we'll talk, as a matter of fact, in the 9 o'clock hour. We're going to spend an hour with WWL Louisiana meteorologist Brooke Laser to talk about not only Milton, but she used to work in an area that was affected by Helene, and we're going to kind of trace that storm and take its path up through the United States and how it caused so much damage in Georgia and North Carolina. But right now we're joined by Dr. Mark Klein, Senior Vice President, Physician-in-Chief and Chief Medical Officer for Children's Hospital New Orleans, because they have a thing. They've been recognized as one of the world's best specialized hospitals for pediatrics. Good morning, Dr. Klein. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Tommy. Good morning to you.
Thanks for taking the time. I'll remind everybody we will be doing our annual Children's Hospital Radiothon, as we do every year. They're still putting the details together on that, but we know how important Children's Hospital is to the community. And tell me about this distinction, if you will, Doc.
Well, we're proud to be recognized for the fourth consecutive year by Newsweek, actually, as one of the world's best children's hospitals. They do a survey of thousands of health professionals across the world. They also look at publicly available hospital quality metrics, results from patient surveys. Anyway, they put it all together, and they rank 250 hospitals across the globe. And here we are. We're the only hospital in Louisiana and this part of the Gulf South that is ranked as among the best children's hospitals in the world. And you know, it's a million little things that lead to a ranking like this, but we're working hard to expand access to the services we provide, taking care of kids with the most complex and serious medical issues. We really feel that children should not ever have to leave the state of Louisiana for the care that they need. They should be able to get it right here at home, and we're doing our best to deliver on that promise.
I know you say a million different things, but talk about some, I know you can't go through all million of them, but talk about some of the things that makes Children's Hospital special and some of the things that you guys focus on.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, Tommy, I would say, you know, we are what is called a comprehensive freestanding children's hospital. That means we cover the waterfront. We do absolutely everything that there is to do. We have every available service for children. There is no specialty in pediatrics that we don't cover. If a child has a complex medical problem or a serious or life-threatening medical issue, this should be the place that they can go. There are other hospitals that call themselves children's hospitals that are more of a boutique nature. They do some things and not others. But we try to attend to medical problems in a very comprehensive and holistic way. We've been growing all of our services over the past number of years. We attracted about 40 new faculty physicians in 2023 alone. We'll have about the same number joining us this year. These are best and brightest, really talented individuals from across the United States who are moving to New Orleans to be part of what we do. I think that's actually a kind of a spinoff benefit of all of this, is bringing a lot of talent to the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana. But that's really the thing, is the comprehensive nature of what we do and the fact that we're four kids and only four kids.
You know, when we are there for the Radiothon, one thing that always touches me and amazes me is the NICU department. Yeah. I was going to say NICU unit, but it is the neonatal intensive care unit. That's kind of like VIN number, right, doctor, where you put that extra letter in there.
Right.
Tell me about that and the work you guys do with that, please.
Well, these are our most fragile patients, I guess. They're often very, very tiny, born prematurely and with other health issues, maybe congenital heart disease or some other kind of congenital anatomic problem of their intestines or their lungs or something else. So they are tiny and fragile, and the doctors and nurses who work in that unit are very adept at taking care of these tiny patients and nursing them along and growing them and feeding them and taking care of what other medical issues they have. And some of them stay a long time. They may stay a year or longer in some cases, reaching kind of a state of stability where they can be discharged home with their moms and dads. So, yeah, that's one of the most important things we do. But, you know, supporting that NICU, we have a really fabulous heart program, and we do a lot of congenital heart surgery here at the hospital. And then we have specialists in any other area you can name to support the NICU and every other area across the hospital.
The you mentioned moms and dads, and a very important part of what you do is treating the whole family, right? When it comes to, and I'm thinking, Doc, of the NICU, and, you know, here's the most precious thing as a parent you can possibly have, and you turn it over to people that, and this is everything to you. This is more valuable than anything you could ever win, own, buy, whatever, and you turn it over to them, and you trust it to them, but part of the care that you provide for the infant is also for the parents, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, they're inextricably linked, invariably, and so we've got a baby or a child that we're taking care of, but they have a mom and a dad, and they have siblings, and we've got to attend to the whole family because when health adversely affects a child, it adversely affects the entire family. We want that whole family to come out on the other side healthy and whole. And so, yes, we have services for the parents and for the kids, the other family members that are affected by this. And so and we address not just the physical health of babies and children, of course, but also their mental and emotional health as well, because those are also invariably linked.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, because Children's Hospital Outreach, also when it comes to protecting kids, extends beyond the hospital. We'll talk about that when we return. We're talking to Dr. Mark Klein, Senior Vice President, Physician in Chief, and Chief Medical Officer for Children's Hospital New Orleans. It's October. December will be here before you know it. It'll be time for the Odyssey Children's Hospital Radiothon. More details on that as we put the event together. 7:51, 9 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. 7:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Mark Klein, Senior Vice President, Physician in Chief, Chief Medical Officer for Children's Hospital New Orleans. They've, once again, 3 years in a row, Doc, been recognized one of the world's best specialized hospitals for pediatrics. 3 years in a row, right?
Four
years in a row.
Yeah, this is our fourth year, Tommy.
And that's inside, that's stuff, we were talking about things you do inside the hospital, but recently, you know, you look at 11-year-old shot and killed in LaPlace. We had a 13-year-old in St. Bernard Parish fatally shot himself mishandling a gun. You had a 15-year-old shot to death along Bundy Road. Talk about some of the things that Children's Hospital is doing to address gun violence. And this is not political at all. This is just about teenagers getting killed is the only point I'm trying to make here. Doc, and pick it up there if you will, please.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, gunshots are one of the leading causes of death for children and adolescents in the United States today. And, you know, too many guns in the hands of kids who don't know how to handle them safely, and guns left unsecured. And so in partnership with the City of New Orleans, we've been distributing biometric gun safes. This is a way of putting a gun away out of the hands of your kids, keeping them safe. these safes can be opened by fingerprint or by a number that can be coded in. We've distributed about 1,200 of these in the New Orleans community so far. We just got an additional $300,000 grant from the city of New Orleans to distribute 800 more. It's just a practical way, Tommy, of locking the gun away, making sure it's available to the adults who own it, but unavailable to kids who might happen upon it, find it, and hurt themselves or hurt another child. And we see way too many kids with gunshots in our emergency department. We're the trauma center for children for the city of New Orleans, and we just see way too many of those, and every single one of them is tragic, and we'd like to prevent them to the extent that we can.
How do people find out more about that, Doctor?
They can go on to chinola.org, chinola.org, to find out more, or call the hospital and just ask about them. And we make them available at a number of community events, and they're free of charge. And we're happy to see them used. And the feedback we've gotten from the folks that have received them is that, you know, this is a practical way of securing a gun that seems to be acceptable to just about everybody.
Thank you, Doctor. God bless y'all. Go ahead. We only have about 20 seconds.
Oh, yeah, Tommy, I was just going to say, you know, partnership is everything. I mentioned this partnership with the city of New Orleans, but, you know, with the schools, the work we do in the schools, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention our two academic partners, Tulane University and LSU Health. We couldn't do any of what we do without all of our good partners.
Thank you, Doc. God bless you.
Hey, Mike Valenti here, host of Cash the Ticket alongside my partner, Jim Costa. It's really simple. Are you tired of podcasts claiming they're a bunch of pro bettors when they live in their mommy's basement? Are you tired of podcasts that claim they hit 80% of the games when really they just lose like most of us? Then Cash the Ticket's the spot for you. We're real. We're transparent. We're having a hell of a good time with it. And we sit there and we're there for the sweat with you guys. We're just trying to figure it out just like you. Follow and listen to Cash the Ticket on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Eight 43, 17 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Wednesday morning, October 9th, joined by Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy and public science and political science, rather, at Duke University. He's previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process, so he knows of what he speaks. How you doing, Bruce?
Doing okay, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
Yes, sir. Here we are 2 days after the one-year anniversary. Give me your summary, your state, if you will, executive summary, however you want to phrase it, of what's going on with Israel and Lebanon and Hamas and Gaza. Jump in where you feel comfortable.
Sure, yeah. I mean, October 7th, you're right, was a very solemn day for the Jewish community in Israel, the United States, elsewhere. More, you know, Jews were killed on that day last year than at any time since the Holocaust. And you know, here at Duke, there was a memorial service that was very well conducted for the student Jewish community. At the same time, in another part of campus, there was a protest by groups that, let's call them pro-Palestine, but both had their own space, which I think is appropriate. And at the same time, you're right, you know, it's no longer, quote-unquote, just Gaza. You know, it's Lebanon, it's possibly the war with Iran. And increasingly, we're seeing big differences between the United States and Israel, not over the core goal. We are committed to Israel's security, but how that is best achieved. And the Netanyahu government has not, frankly, been a very good ally. We've been supporting them, and they've been doing things without giving us notice, against our advice, and also against the advice of many of their own military strategists. It's not just us caring about ourselves, but there's big debate about what's best for Israel right now.
Where does this, because you've been involved in this, right? You work for the State Department. You know where the personalities come in. Bob Woodward's book comes out. I don't know what's true, what's not, but quoting some of the language that President Biden used, referring to Netanyahu, I'm sure Netanyahu had some choice words about President Biden. Where in the efforts of international diplomacy do personalities factor into this, Bruce?
They really do a lot, a huge amount. I mean, you can go back to Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in the end of the Cold War, and those two men got along really well, more than some of their hawkish aides wanted them to, and it really had good results. Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu have a very long history. When I was in the State Department in 2009, 2011, There were some issues, you know, in which when Biden was vice president, when Netanyahu did some things to him on one of his visits to Israel that they were kind of in your face. I give Biden a lot of credit. He's basically said to Bibi, you know, I'm going to hug you and I love you and your country, but you drive me crazy, right? And so Biden has really tried not to let personal emotions get in the way of the relationship. But increasingly, he really feels that Netanyahu has not been trustworthy. And when you're working with an ally, whether it's Ukraine or Israel or any other country that we have partnership with, you got to have trust, right? Even when you disagree, you got to have trust. And there have been a number of indications lately where Netanyahu has done things that, frankly, are seen as serving his own political interests of survival, not necessarily the interests of his own country, as well as kind of leaving the United States in a really tough place.
At the end of it all, though, despite all the political noise, Netanyahu knows that Israel needs the United States, and Biden knows that the United States has to support Israel, right?
He does. But, you know, supporting Israel, the big distinction, I think, has been between our support for Israel against attacks from its really external enemies like Iran. You know, in April when Iran attacked, it was American military capacity along with Israeli that prevented that from really penetrating, you know, in Israeli airspace. Now the question now with this latest attack by Iran, and a very serious one. I mean, I have Israeli friends, and some of these missiles that got through landed within a couple, you know, miles of their house in Tel Aviv. But, you know, we are trying to contain this and stop it from becoming a full regional war. The Iranian foreign minister is now in Saudi Arabia talking to the Saudis, right? And they're big enemies. And so we want to kind of follow that path of how do we contain this rather than escalate it. We believe that's in the region's interest, in Israel's interest, including the Arab countries that are pro-Israel. They don't want a further war. That hurts them as well. So I feel like we're trying to take care of Israel, but in ways that Netanyahu seems to have his own agenda.
Put this Middle East puzzle together for me, if you will, Bruce. Who wants what where?
Interesting. You know, a lot of people saying now the two people that most want the conflict to continue are the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, and Prime Minister Netanyahu. Sinwar, I mean, it's one of those ironies. The Israelis assassinated one of the other leaders of Hamas when he was in Iran a couple months ago. And while they felt they got a bad guy, this guy was actually more pro-negotiations than Sinwar, and now Sinwar has more control over Hamas, right? So you get the guy, and it actually makes your problems worse. Sinwar, you know, he has sacrificed, you know, tens of thousands of his own people in the name of what he sees as the cause, and Netanyahu has been resisting. There are still 101 hostages held in Gaza. And with the Jewish New Year here, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the families want the hostages back, and they're prepared for a ceasefire. They're not prepared to just tell Hamas, you know, do whatever you want to do. And so Netanyahu has been the one resisting this, who seems to think that his own interests are best served by the war continuing. And so he and Sinwar actually are, you know, kind of on the same page in their own way.
I follow this, and I need to refresh myself every now and then. So let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll distinguish Hamas from Hezbollah. And also, you mentioned Reagan and Gorbachev's relationship, and I know you study the Middle East, but you know diplomacy. And I'd like to compare and contrast that to what else came out in Bob Woodward's book about Donald Trump's relationship with purported relationship with Vladimir Putin and the differences or similarities. 850, 10 till 9, Bruce Jemison worked with the State Department. He knows what he's talking about, knows the players involved, and interesting to hear that personalities do enter into it. Right now, 850, 10 till 9, traffic, WWL. 855, 5 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Bruce Jemison, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process. Bruce, when it comes to Hamas, Hezbollah, the differences, and while you're at it, recap who else it is that has beef with Israel and from whom they have to defend themselves.
Yeah, so Hezbollah is in Lebanon. And, you know, in the Sunni-Shia splits in Islam, they're a Shia group, so they have a lot in common with Iran. And they really have been, of all the different groups, most closely connected to Iran in terms of money, weapon supplies, and the like. And they have been on the northern part of Israel, kind of there was a war in 2006. There's been, you know, constant, and since last year there was a lot of barrages. Israel's had to evacuate probably 50, 60,000 people from, you know, communities in its north. Hamas is actually Sunni, so it doesn't have that religious tie to Iran, and they're Palestinian. You know, one of the main groups, the other being the Palestinian Authority, that was the group that Israel and the United States have been negotiating with. And they're in Gaza. They have some supporters in the West Bank and elsewhere. But they hadn't really been that close. You know, when Hamas did its massacre on October 7th, Hezbollah responded the next day with attacks. But it wasn't like, in fact, the leader of Hezbollah, who recently got killed by the Israelis, said, short of a knife, so they told me this was coming, you know. So there wasn't, they weren't that close. You know, Israel, when it was created in 1948, every single Arab state in the region, including Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, you know, tried to make sure it didn't happen. It was one of the first acts of the United Nations. There were supposed to be an Israel and a Palestine. And they all declared war on Israel. So over the years, Israel made peace with Egypt. It made peace with Jordan. It has some other relations with other Arab countries, even a little bit with Saudi Arabia. But go back to 1948, and it was a war of all the Arab world against Israel.
If you go back to the Yom Kippur War, if Israel doesn't take the stance that it does and Egypt wins that war, then Egypt is – the whole situation is completely different, is it not?
Yeah, and a few years after that war – when, you know, that Egypt didn't succeed, Israel defended itself, but it incurred tremendous, you know, losses and costs. It was 5 years after that that the President Carter, bless his heart on his 100th birthday, negotiated with the leader of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, and the leader of Israel, Menachem Begin, who was an Israeli hawk, by the way, the Camp David Treaty. And that's held up for, what, 50, almost 50 years now, even with tensions? Not bad for a peace treaty.
Have
right?
Have you seen the movie Golda, Bruce?
I haven't seen. I read her biography, but I did not see the movie.
I just wonder if it was accurate or not, because it seems as though, and if you want a peek behind the scenes about the way diplomacy works, I would suggest maybe people watch that movie, because it seemed pretty real to me. I don't know. Before we let you go, let me talk about the comparison you made with Reagan and Gorbachev and their friendship and how that helped with the Cold War. What about the friendship that we hear about now, or purported friendship, in Bob Woodward's book between former President Trump and Vladimir Putin? Comparisons there or not?
Very different. Let me simply say that any previous ex-president, when they've talked to a foreign leader that they had relations with, they cleared it with the existing president, and they never did it with a president, with a leader that the United States was at war with, like we are with Putin. Reagan and Gorbachev pursued a common goal of good relations between the countries and trying to make the world a more peaceful place. I don't think that's what Putin's doing, and I don't know what Trump would be talking to him about that might be serving the interests of peace and American interests.
But certainly outside the norm?
Well, outside the norm. Far, you know, blows it out of the water.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your time as always. Bruce Johnson, okay. Professor of Public Policy, Political Science, Duke, previously worked State Department, Middle East Peace Process. We come back. We're going to talk hurricanes. We're going to trace the path of Helene and see why it caused. All right. Thank you. 908. Brooke Laser joins us in the studio now. It's nice to meet this young lady who is a graduate of Mount Carmel Academy. What's that? Oh, we've got to get the microphone ready. We don't have. We're Brooke, this is not TV. We're pretty bare bones operation here. You understand what I'm saying? You're on your own.
You are on your own.
Survival of the fittest, so good luck to you.
We know that feeling.
Let's talk about you real quick. Mount Carmel graduate, and you went to Mississippi State, is that right?
Yes, you've got it.
And then decided to become a meteorologist. That's why you went to Mississippi State. Then worked at a TV station. Now you're at Channel 4. What made you decide that you wanted to be a weather person? Because I don't envy what you all do, because you're predicting the future is what you're doing, and a lot of people are basing a lot of stuff based on your predictions, and they hold you responsible for it, right?
They do, without a doubt. We get a lot of that flack for potentially being wrong and still having a job, but, you know, we'll take it. It's a great career. But, of course, Katrina was my inspiration on studying
it. Was it really?
Yeah, born and raised here. I was only 10 when the storm hit, believe it or not, so... At that time, my father was running his business and under immense stress because of the storm and keeping his firm alive and everyone employed, and it just had a big impact. So I really knew then I wanted to study this and followed it to college and have been so fortunate for a dream come true of returning home and serving New Orleans, especially during Ida.
That had to be kind of weird when, I'm trying to think, which was it? I get the names confused. What did we have when we stayed here, Tim? What was it when we stayed overnight?
Ida,
was that it?
Francine.
I don't know. They name them all. They need to quit naming them repeatedly because we've been through like three Ivans or whatever it is. What was the latest one that hit us this summer?
Francine,
okay.
Yes.
But it had to have been kind of odd for you to be on TV talking about Francine and referencing Katrina when that was what caused you to go into the weather, right?
Yeah, you know, it's full circle. And Katrina has been a big date for me in my career because I interviewed for my first position in New Orleans on the anniversary, and then I was able to make an announcement on coming to WWL on the anniversary. So mm-hmm. I had decided 16 years prior to being able to serve during Ida that I wanted to study weather, and then that dream became a reality, if you will. So it really has been an important date.
And you worked in Augusta, Georgia, or close to there? What is
your
story? I
did. Yes. Augusta was my first market out of college, and I had such an incredible experience there. It was definitely my favorite market other than New Orleans, which is home. And I'm fortunate for usually going back in April, so I'm very thankful for that. But I've been feeling for them coming off of Helene. They have really experienced so much devastation, and the storm really came as a shock there so far inland. So I've been keeping up with all my friends that are still recovering and just got power back within the last 48 hours.
When you say Augusta, is your dad a golfer?
My father is a golfer. My grandfather was a bigger golfer in New Orleans, just in his pastime. But I'm not. I'm a great spectator.
I'm just saying this. Whenever you say Augusta, the point of reference becomes Augusta National, right?
For most people.
Did you spend some time there or not?
Yes, I did. When I worked there, I was fortunate to do a little bit of forecasting for the Masters. And then,
really?
Yeah, I've gone back each April since 2017, which has been amazing. It's certainly an experience that I think...
Going back to do what?
Just to be a patron at the Masters.
Oh, okay.
That everyone should take if they ever get the opportunity to experience it.
You really can't enjoy the golf course on television like you can if you see it, right? With the rises and the elevations and the hills and the flowers and so forth.
Oh, my goodness. The elevation is wild. This past year, after Sunday, my ankles were swollen, which is unusual, but you walk so much and you're walking uphill, and it is a lot of physical exercise just to go and see the golfers play. So, yes.
How many people have in your lifetime said, hey, Brooke, can you get me on Augusta?
Oh, my goodness. So
a lot?
Yes, a lot. But I wish I had those powers. I do not have them by any means. Have you ever been there, Tommy?
No, I'd just like to ask one more time. Can you get me on Augusta, Brooke? No, but I'd love to go. Let's talk about, because the reason I wanted to have you on, we were trying to look for somebody who could take us through the path of Helene and how it could cause so much damage inland, because I've been to Biltmore in North Carolina and Asheville, and I'm trying to, in my mind, figure out, well, how can a hurricane cause that much damage? So what I thought it might be interesting to do is take us from the time Helene hit in Florida, take us through that, and then from there we'll morph into Milton. And before we get to the places outside of Florida, let's start with Helene and Milton and look at where Milton's scheduled to hit and what areas were impacted by Helene and where they could be getting the double whammy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's just so tough to fathom, you know, waking up this morning and seeing all the coverage of the evacuations and the traffic. It's such a familiar feeling here, and you can't help but just have goosebumps, especially thinking about those debris piles that are still on the road and could become even further in terms of, you know, that destruction or...
Yeah, wind's going to whip all...
Right.
It would be like, for example, and we had the scare with Rita here. I don't know where you were, but what your Katrina story is, but they had all that debris piled up on West End, and it would be similar or akin, I guess, to a storm coming in and blowing that all over?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Just additional trajectories and lofted debris to become more of a problem. So I am just feeling for everybody down there, but I guess we'll go back with the timeline for Helene when the initial landfall happened. It was late on September 26th, right? And overnight landfalls are tough because it's dark. So it's all the more scary in that you can't exactly see what's happening. And I'm sure a lot of people here have experienced that before as well. But it essentially worked its way beyond the Big Bend and then maintained such intensity and strength all the way into, as a lot of people know, Georgia and South Carolina. And Augusta was, you know, well inland and took the direct eyewall hit, which was not exactly forecasted. So that community was very surprised to experience everything they did go through. And that, of course, adds to it so much as well. I think you had the same situation in North Carolina. You know, we're so fortunate here that we know what a hurricane is like. We know how to prepare. And more often than not, we leave because there's just no reason to stay and experience all the negativity on the back end without any resources. But to go through it without any preparation, even simply water, gas, you know, things along those lines, that's really unimaginable on the backside, especially when you have all these trees down and then the power lines come down and you have gas leaks and the list goes on. But then the flooding on top in North Carolina is just so tough to fathom. And I'm sure you feel the same way, Tommy. I've been talking with my friends in Augusta and they'll describe the refrigerator smell or, you know, the flood water smell from a couple of my friends up in Asheville. And you can still smell those same scents when you hear somebody say it, if you did go through that during Katrina. So it is just a tough experience all around.
I think that's why it resonates so much with us here, because we did go through it. We do see it on TV. We understand, like you're talking about, even the refrigerator smells or the debris piles, what it is they're going through. So when it comes to Helene, where did it land in Florida, and how does that compare and contrast with where Milton is headed?
So two somewhat different areas, Big Bend region as opposed to Tampa. And yes, the map is always a great thing. But as it continued to move inland, it went in a very different direction than Milton will go. So Tampa, of course, did experience a good bit of surge with this past storm, somewhere between, I want to say, 6 and 8 feet, whereas the forecast here is between 10 and 15. So that is a very significant difference. But as this one moved inland, Helene continued up through Georgia and then into the Carolinas. And you had a couple of different factors contributing to the overall damage assessment. A lot of times with the National Weather Service assessments, we don't always confirm exactly what happened until after the fact. And it comes from looking at all the damage and then sort of coming up with a wind speed or a further assessment of, you know, maybe a tornado has come through here, or we had an eyewall scenario where it was a mesocyclone. So in those initial days right after the storm, we don't always have confirmation on the exact impact until the cleanup effort is really complete. But one thing that I looked into significantly with Georgia and the Carolinas was the elevation and how that contributed to such a wild scenario unfolding. And of course, these tropical systems are so large scale, right? But the rainfall was the primary issue in the Carolinas, not only during the storm, but also the events that happened before the storm came through. So you already had saturated ground, you already had swollen rivers, and then you have this coming on top, dumping another 30 inches of rain in the Asheville area. And those rivers start to swell, and then you have the terrain also
30
adding.
Inches of rain?
Yes, 30 inches of rain. A little more than that, actually.
In what, maybe a day or two?
In about 3 days.
Wow.
So that's, of course, a slightly larger timeline, but that's more than they would traditionally see for the month of September as a whole. Mm-hmm. So just an unbelievable amount of moisture in the atmosphere and on the ground. And there's something called orographic lifting, which is this concept where in the hills and the mountains, air is forced to rise and it cools a little more quickly. That causes the water vapor to then condense and additional precipitation forms. So that was combining with Helene's impact, and all of that moisture was essentially pooling in the valleys, squeezing the moisture out of the atmosphere. You had it running through the valleys, in the rivers and the streams, basically. So that's what really led to that extreme flood scenario in the Carolinas. And it's just not something they typically experience. I mean, you don't usually have hurricanes that far inland, but it really is so tough to know what a storm is going to do once it makes landfall. And I learned that during Ida, because I hadn't personally experienced a hurricane before. I'd always evacuated. Mm-hmm. So you can watch them as a meteorologist when they're in the water and you know all the different areas to target, what to look for factor-wise, the water temperature, your dry air or shear that can break a storm up. But once it gets inland and it sort of loses that fuel source, it's very tough to navigate exactly what the storm's going to do because it sort of just has a mind of its own. So I think you had sort of the perfect storm come together for this particular scenario to evolve. But it definitely is a reminder as a meteorologist of how important the forecast is for all areas that could potentially experience these impacts, because it is just such a better experience when you're prepared, of course.
I guess it's speculation, but would this have been better had it come in from the Atlantic, say through Norfolk, than the way it did, or that's just no way to tell?
Better in what way?
Well,
less impact?
Less impact, yeah.
You know, I think it probably would have been, because the path it took, of course, affected the areas it affected in that it went right over those locations. Mm-hmm. But I think it just depends on the particular place and a lot of factors beyond the storm itself. With Tampa, you know, I was researching their preparation efforts, and I remember during Hurricane Ian, which was back in 2022, which ended up a little bit further south of the Tampa area, they had put a preparation at Tampa General, the hospital, for example, in place with
that wall.
Yeah,
I saw that.
15-foot flood wall. And, you know, that is something that I think we'd benefit greatly from here. Yeah. I just don't know if it's something that we've ever thought about as a resource. But of course, that would prevent the experience like you had at Baptist during Katrina, mm-hmm. more than likely with all the flooding. So they certainly have a lot of preparations that they have used time and time again. And that flood wall worked during Helene, and it really did save them in a sense. But of course, the surge forecast was not as significant as this one will be. So the forecast is 15 feet. The flood wall is 15 feet. So that is probably going to be enough, hopefully. But when you fathom 15 feet of water, mm-hmm. it really is unimaginable.
Let me take a break. We're going to pick it up when we come back. And I've lived here all my life, except for maybe about a year in Vegas where I worked. And that's, you know, Vegas in a valley. So there are some ups and downs, nowhere near like Augusta, Georgia. And having been to Asheville, the reason I wanted to have you in, my mind, I just can't wrap it around a mountainous area like that flooding. I just can't imagine how in the world could, because it's always downhill from there, how could anything flood? But I guess with 30 inches of rain, the rivers get swollen, and then Asheville floods.
Yeah.
Have you been to Biltmore or not?
I have.
Yeah,
amazing. It's beautiful.
My house in Belcher is bigger than that.
Oh, my goodness.
It really is.
Well,
it's amazing.
You'll have to have me up there.
The fireplace alone, bigger than that. All right, 9:22, we'll take a break. Brooke Laser is our guest. That's how you pronounce it, Laser, right?
Yeah, like a beam.
And a new meteorologist over at WWR Louisiana, worked in Augusta, Georgia. So we're talking about the impacts of Helene, and then we'll get back and talk about Milton as well and Tampa Bay and the storm surge and how just a couple of miles can make all the difference as to whether water gets pushed into Tampa or out. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. It is 9:28. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend, our newest, bestest weather friend, Brooke Laser, WWL TV meteorologist. Alexandra Cranford had her baby, so you're an aunt
yes.
now, right?
Oh, my goodness. I wouldn't say that. I could not get over how precious he is,
it's
though.
The fraternity of weather people that makes you an aunt. Your Aunt Brooke.
I'll take it. So I can't wait to meet him.
So let's talk about Milton and going into Florida, and as opposed to Helene and Tampa Bay, because it all, you talk about 10 to 15 feet of storm surge, the way these things are designed, the hurricanes, or at least the way they develop, it depends on, 10 miles can make a hell of a difference as to whether it pushes water into the bay or out of Tampa Bay, right?
Yes, absolutely. And they've been really fortunate for essentially dodging the last few threats each time. So that 20-mile difference is a huge difference in terms of the eventual impact. And it seems like the storm has been trending a little bit further right of the initial forecast track, which is bringing it right into the bay. So if that does verify, then this will certainly be something they haven't seen in over 100 years. But it is wild to think about the Bucks being here this week as well, having relocated.
What about the composition of the storm itself? We hear about Category 5 mm-hmm. and barometric pressure, and I never did quite understand. Matter of fact, you know what? If y'all have any questions, 504-260-1870, and we'll pass them along to Brooke about the hurricanes. And, you know, a lot of us go back to remembering Nash as a kid, not you.
Of course.
Certainly you're too young for that. But And they'd give us the hurricane maps, and we'd draw the eye of the hurricane. And by the time you tried to get it even, you covered the whole Gulf with the storm. But this storm does take up a lot of the Gulf, right?
Oh, yeah, it does. I have a similar map. I can't quite draw on it, but it has magnetic tacks that you move. Yes, so I use it almost every day. It was my grandfather's. But every day during hurricane season, of course. But, yes.
Yeah, because if you did it in March, it would just be weird.
It would. But, yeah, this one's been really interesting to watch. And on Monday, as we were seeing it so rapidly intensify, basically from a tropical storm to Category 5 in 24 hours, I was looking at the barometric pressure, as you just mentioned, Tommy, and a lot of people don't necessarily know what that means for a storm.
That
but
would be me. I don't understand. My mom used to always say, when the pressure drops, it's bad, but I don't know why or what that means.
Right. So when the pressure is dropping, the storm's intensifying. And this storm actually got down to just 2 millibars higher than Rita. And Rita has the record for the lowest pressure ever before in the Gulf of Mexico. So it did start to rise again, basically hit 897 millibars. The standing record is 895. And then it started to rise again back into the 900s as we approached Monday night. But this thankfully had some dry air to encounter. So that's why you saw the winds drop off a bit starting Monday. And they've stayed in that Category 4 range since. But now the forecast for landfall is back up to Category 4 intensity. So that's why, as meteorologists, we always say, don't focus on the category. Of course, that's just accounting wind speed. And it is sort of wild that that's our measurement, if you will, and it only factors one impact into the equation, if that makes sense. But with this storm, storm surge is really going to be the biggest concern. And of course, I mean, you think about the weight of water and you think about what's in the water. I mean, during Ida, I remember our reporters were coming back with the wildest content after the storm. We had a reporter that broke the news about the individual in Slidell that was drug away by an alligator. There was an alligator uptown that ended up in a dumpster. You know, you think about the swamp that rushes into our area during these storms. Well, Florida, the gators are very similar. You know, you've got wildlife in the water. You've got debris. Again, we're talking about leftover from Helene that gets picked up and starts to flood in. You've got furniture from inside. You've got cars at times. It's just unimaginable to think about, really. And I remember also during Ida, I didn't expect this, but when I went to check on my parents' home, which was completely fine after Ida, I mentally went back to being on my grandmother's front steps in Lakeview during Katrina. And it was like the reverse effect, because of course her home was not okay then, and my parents was. But my dad had asked me to go up into the attic and check for leaks. And I got up there and it was so hot and it was so dark. And all I could think about were the people in Lafitte that we'd covered experiencing rising water the night before during Ida. And I can't imagine being in that situation where it's dark, water's rising, you don't have access to information or any resources to call for help, and what you're left to make a decision on, you know? So that's why I, as a meteorologist, always encourage people to leave if they have the ability, because it's just not worth staying, in my opinion. I know a lot of people have always stayed and like to ride these storms out, but of course I have to stay. I wouldn't if I didn't have to, you know?
Yeah, same here. And you know, we got calls during Katrina from people that were in attics, and there was a lot of misinformation or disinformation. People didn't know exactly what was going on. But the thought I had, Brooke, was, having been in an attic in the summertime, is that one thing that gets lost, and you just brought it up, is how incredibly hot it is in there and dark after the power goes out, presuming you had lights up there to begin with, and how miserable that must be.
Yes.
What about Disney World and Milton? And, well, because so many of us here have made the pilgrimage with kids to Disney World and the Magic Kingdom. What kind of damage are they likely to look at from Milton?
Yeah, you know, it's wild to think about. They're going to definitely see at least a Category 2 there, without a doubt. And I know Disney World is closed, which is rare. I feel like they don't do that unless they basically have a hurricane impact coming or some type of additional weather scenario. But nonetheless, they will be experiencing pretty significant impacts. I'm sure they'll be able to get back open as quickly as possible, but I need to look into the process for boarding up Magic Kingdom, as we just talked about, mm-hmm. because I'm sure it's an extensive effort. And I did see that Tampa's airport was closing yesterday morning and Orlando's was closing this morning. So I'm sure that adds to some of the difficulty. I've had a couple friends that were there message me within the last few days about their plan to reroute and travel differently. But I think everyone that is there has been paying close attention to this for at least the last few days.
Might seem trivial, but for people that are fans of Augusta, do you know how badly the golf course was damaged by Helene?
You know, I was talking about that last night, and there hasn't been a whole lot of information on it. I do know the National donated $5 million to Augusta itself for the ability to recover, which is nice, of course, but they do a pretty good job of keeping everything sealed up there in terms of
all
the logistics.
It's not a public course. You don't just walk on and pay a green fee and play. They're kind of exclusive with what they let out.
They are. I will say the hill, which is the neighborhood or the area where Augusta National is located, was really badly damaged in comparison on other parts of the town. So North Augusta is actually in South Carolina, and that is across the Savannah River. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Augusta, Georgia is on the other side. So it's really interesting. The town sits on the state line. And the hill area was far more impacted than North Augusta was. And I think the elevation, again, had a little bit to do with that. As you mentioned, the course is very hilly. And the hill is, too. That's why it's called the hill. But they just had so much more wind damage there. And there are so many trees there. And we have so many trees here. But if you think about the North Shore and all the pine trees there, it's sort of a similar feel when you're driving around the Augusta area. And I happened to be at the tournament last year, 2023, when the two trees fell. Do you remember hearing about that? It was a wild experience because when you're on the course, you're not allowed to have your phone. So you're just sort of reverting in time, and it's great because you have to be present, and that's what makes the experience so special. But when those trees fell, everybody started to sort of have panic rush over them, and you realize that no one's exempt from the human experience. So the golfers started to run, the caddies were running, and all the patrons were looking around with the additional trees swaying as well, having to sort of rush off the course, and you can't call an Uber, you know.
Right.
You have to have either parked or you catch a cab, mm-hmm. like back in the day. So all that being said, just from that one experience of it was an outflow boundary with a 60-mile-per-hour wind and those two trees coming down, I can only imagine when they were sustaining 100-mile-per-hour winds,
wow.
what the course must look like. But I can guarantee you it will be picked up and back to perfection.
Pristine.
Soon, yeah. Yes.
I will take a break, pick it up, we come back. Somebody texted in, they don't understand what barometric pressure is, so perhaps you could explain that. Somebody else wants to know about how high are the walls of a hurricane. Because
okay.
I saw the footage yesterday of the Hurricane Hunters going in. I don't know if you saw that or not, and they got jostled around. And they think I'm crazy around here because I would love to go on a ride with a Hurricane Hunter. Would you like to do that?
Oh, my gosh, that's my dream.
Yeah, I would love to do that. I think it'd be fun.
It is my dream. We'll see one day, I hope, that
happens. All right, 938, 22 till 10, traffic now, WWL. All right, 945, spending an hour with Brooke Laser talking about hurricanes and Milton and Helene and how it caused so much damage. And we understand now that what happened in North Carolina was 30 inches of rain mm-hmm. with, I guess, riverine flooding is what it was, where it just, and then I'm going to butcher this, I know, but the valleys and something sucked up moisture or something? Is that what you told me?
Yes, we were talking about orographic lifting as a concept, if you want to further research
that. That's where you
fold
a paper up, right?
Origami. Oh. It does sound like origami, mm-hmm. doesn't it? I know, there are so many wild terms in weather. Believe me, it's crazy to attempt to study. And the thing is, as much as you try, it's really difficult to ever fully grasp the ability nature has, you know? So with each different storm, I'm always so impressed. And Peyton and I were both marveling at Milton on Monday as it was just rapidly intensifying, unlike anything we've really seen recently. So I also did some research, Tommy, because a lot of people are saying you don't usually hear about Category 5 storms in October. You know, it's later in the season. Certainly here, we're usually feeling like we're out of the woods by September, right. once we get past that August 29th, of course. But in history, recently, and you'll remember this a little better than I do, 1998, there was Hurricane Mitch. Do you remember that?
What does that mean? Yes, well, I was only Mitch. Four. Yes, I do. I remember Mitch.
I was only four at the time. So I don't remember that one. Do you remember it here in New Orleans, impacting New Orleans?
I do. Maybe.
Yeah?
I get the names all confused, so I don't know.
I was talking to somebody last night that said they were in law school at Loyola at the time, and there was flooding here. So that's interesting because it made landfall, I want to say, in Florida. Mm-hmm. But then we had Wilma, which everybody remembers. Again, Katrina, Rita season. That was 2005. And then Michael, which was 2018. So those are the Gulf Category 5 October storms that I researched most recently. And Michael actually made landfall on October 10th. That was in the Mexico Beach area. So that was not quite Destin 30A, but a little bit past Panama City. So that was along the panhandle, whereas...
Michael was devastating.
Oh, absolutely devastating. Yeah. I remember watching it, you know, watching the national coverage of it and just thinking, my goodness. And one of my former coworkers was actually in the Destin area and her station was completely gone. They completely rebuilt it. Mm. So
the best ever was Zeta because at
oh
least
my goodness.
It was cool.
Yes.
After it happened.
And
you
that was
have the windows open and it was nice. It was in late October, Halloween, I think it was
October 28th. I won't forget it.
So what is barometric pressure? Somebody texted that in.
It's really a very simple definition. It's just the pressure within the atmosphere of the Earth. So when you look at a big synoptic storm like this, and that just means a large scale storm, we sort of vary the different weather impacts based on the mesoscale feature, which means the scale of the storm itself. You're looking at this system as the pressure drops, intensifying. And a lot of people may not understand why that happens. But when we're looking at hurricanes, the pressure dropping means the winds pick up. And again, we talked about the categories. That's how we measure hurricanes. The hurricane hunters are flying through these systems. I don't know if a lot of people realize hurricane hunters are all meteorologists that are part of the Air Force. Mm-hmm. So it's really an incredible job because you have to go through so much additional training, obviously, to fly these planes. And yes, I would also love to do that. That is my dream. I got to see one of the aircrafts up in Biloxi at Keesler Air Force Base, which is where they fly a lot of their missions from. But they take off from different bases depending on where the storm is. And they fly those missions until just before landfall, until the storm is over land. And that's when they can no longer fly in and out of them. But they are sending drop zones into the center of the storm, and those are firing back pressure recordings and wind speed recordings. So that's how we then, as meteorologists on the ground, get our information for these updates. And, you know, there's the system of the timing and when the National Hurricane Center is issuing those updates each time as well. And they start to do some intermediate advisories as landfall is approaching. So that'll continue to happen today. But this is another one that's going to hit very late after dark and then into the overnight hours. And with Helene, you know, of course, landfall was 11 o'clock. I know Augusta was experiencing the storm by 5 a.m. on Friday morning. So you're going to see the Disney World area, Orlando, experiencing this in the overnight hours. And then Jacksonville will get it a little bit earlier tomorrow morning.
Seems like people say they always land at night. Do they or not?
Not always. I mean, Zeta, we just talked about it.
Yeah.
That was sort of the perfect storm, and it came through at 3 p.m. I remember Hank Allen at WGNO saying, love this storm coming through in the middle of the day, in and out of here. You know, the eyewall went right over New Orleans with that one. And like you said, a cold front was the reason that it was steered our direction, whereas in this situation, the cold front steered Milton away from us. So then it was cool on the backside, even though we didn't have power. And I'll never forget being so impressed by New Orleans because we didn't have power, but people were still at Galatoire's Halloween. You know, I mean, it's just New Orleans for you, and similar with the last
You're
one.
You're a New Orleans
Francine.
Gal, aren't you? If you know about Galatoire's,
love going there.
Real quick, when it comes to the rest of the season and anything else that's out there, what are you seeing?
Yeah, you know, it has been about what we were anticipating in terms of the number of storms. And you're getting these situations with Francine, with Milton, where they're developing in that Bay of Campeche area, and then they just quickly move towards land. So traditionally, by now, we're essentially out of the woods, but the Gulf is warm, and it's still hot out there right now. You know, of course, it's October, and we're
so
in the upper 80s.
So the concern now, Brooke, is not the Atlantic. The concern is stuff that in the Bay of Campeche and all that area down there that stirs up?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've been looking at a little bit more recently. I think it's relatively rare that you see a storm start off of Africa's coast, cross the Atlantic, and come all the way over to us. Usually, the ones that we're watching are a little bit closer to the Yucatan or the Bay of Campeche as they start to develop and then move our way into the Gulf or across the Gulf. So I think at this point, we're probably getting close to being out of the woods. We don't even have 2 full months left of hurricane season, but just kind of got to keep our fingers crossed and keep watching.
All we can do. Thank you, Brooke Blazer. A pleasure meeting you, and thank you for the information, all that stuff.
Thank you for having me.
All right. 9:53, we'll take a break. Newell's got the governor coming on at 10 o'clock, around 10:10, right after the news. So stay tuned for that. We'll also find out what else he's got planned when we come back on WWL.
Hey, Mike Valeni here, host of Cash the Ticket alongside my partner, Jim Costa. It's really simple. Are you tired of podcasts claiming they're a bunch of pro bettors when they live in their mommy's basement? Are you tired of podcasts that claim they hit 80% of the games when really they just lose like most of us? Then Cash the Ticket's the spot for you. We're real. We're transparent. We're having a hell of a good time with it. And we sit there and we're there for the sweat with you guys. We're just trying to figure it out just like you. Follow and listen to Cash the Ticket on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.